The reading today is John's Gospel, page 89 in the New Testament, chapter 2, beginning at verse 1. The wedding at Cana. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and me? My hour has not yet come." He tells you. Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they remained there for a few days.
And maybe you're expecting the reading from Matthew 2. I was chatting to someone today who thought there was a misprint on the reading, and we deliberately did choose this passage. Matthew 2 is often the passage that we hear about the Magi coming to bring their gifts to the child, Jesus. Sometimes this is the season that we associate where we think about Jesus being baptized in the river. And if you remember, the Spirit comes down in the form of the dove, and the voice of the Father speaks words of affirmation over Jesus, the whole Trinity. And we see God revealing Jesus, his presence and his power and his divinity. This is who he is. He's not just a man. He's God. But actually this passage in John 2, which many of us will be familiar with, has always been associated with this particular season of Epiphany. And the church has deliberately put it in this part of the liturgical year to use this passage. And the church fathers from, you know, just very early in the life of the church, they were trying to reflect that what happens at this wedding, when Jesus turns water into wine, and we're going to look at that today, is on the same scale in terms of revealing who he is as the baptism of Jesus and the Magi coming to visit him. Something about his glory, his true identity, was unveiled in that moment when he turned water into wine. He was made manifest for humanity to see. You'll have heard of Thomas Jefferson. He was one of the founding fathers of America. He was the principal author of the Declaration of Independence and the third president of the United States. And Thomas Jefferson was fascinated by Jesus. But he was also a man of science, and he couldn't reconcile this stuff about miracles and supernatural. He just couldn't hold those two things together, science and the miraculous. And so he resolved and dealt with this problem in a very simple way. He took a scalpel and he cut out of the Gospels anything that referred to the supernatural or the miraculous, including the resurrection, by the way. And he focused solely on Jesus's teaching, is amazing teaching, is ethical teaching. And Jefferson's Bible, his somewhat abridged Bible called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. You can see that if you go to Washington in the Smithsonian Museum of American History. And you know, we can kind of do that with the Bible. Not literally, I hope, but we can respond to Jesus in a similar kind of way. We can skip over parts of Scripture that we find uncomfortable or we don't like, and we can dwell in the ones that we do. So some theologians have done what Jefferson did, and they take the supernatural elements of what Jesus did, like he did in this reading, and they can say, well, those are kind of imaginary. They're legends, they're metaphor, and they're written by the gospel writer purely to illustrate something deeper, a kind of spiritual truth. They didn't really happen, but the gospel writer is trying to tell us something else. And others of us will actually go to the opposite extreme, actually, and make our life all about the miracles. That our life with God has to be kind of consistently miraculous. That our prayer life is like a vending machine where you put a request in and you expect the answer that you expect to come out at the other end. And actually, faith in Jesus isn't quite as simple as that. I believe Jesus did, and I believe he continues to do wonderful signs and wonders. But he always cautioned those people who were with him purely about seeking the miraculous. There's a time in John 6, just a few chapters later, where he challenges those people who want the next miracle. You know, you came for the bread and you got the bread. Next special sign. Notice that John in this passage is really careful not to call this a miracle. He calls it the first of Jesus's signs. And writers suggest that those signs, that is how John describes it, they're like clues in a treasure hunt for us to identify a little bit more and discover a little bit more about who Jesus is. They're moments when heaven invades earth, where heaven is open and the transforming power of God's love bursts into the present. It's like getting a magnifying glass and taking the sun, and the intensity of God's presence is revealed in a really profound and clear way. But John's concern when he writes these signs is not just that we're impressed by them, by the awesome nature of what Jesus did. He's not just trying to say, well, oh, he can do that, so that must mean he is God. Although that, I think, is true. He's trying to help us a little bit further. That we follow the signpost of the sign to what it actually says about who Jesus is. He writes in verse 11, Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and he revealed his glory. In this turning water into wine, Jesus revealed his glory. I don't know what you associate glory with. We kind of talk about a glorious performance, or yesterday in the FA Cup, glorious goal, or a national celebration, or even the possibility of incredible sacrifice on the battlefield. He died, or she died, a glorious death. And especially in John's gospel, there are loads of these themes, like signs. Another thing is about glory. John talks about glory a lot. So right at the start of the gospel, and we looked at this over Christmas in chapter 1, John says, we've seen his glory. The glory of the one and only Son, full of grace and truth. For John, the glory of Jesus is inextricably connected with what happens to him later. For John, the supreme sign of Jesus' glory, the supreme moment of Jesus being glorified, is when he dies on a cross. That is the crowning glory for John, for Jesus. But that glory is also revealed, John says, in the signs, in the miracles. So for example, in chapter 11, he raises Lazarus from the dead. He's one of his best friends. And Jesus says, this is for God's glory, that God's Son may be glorified through it. And here again in chapter 2, the first of the signs is to reveal his glory. We think Jesus is probably around about 30 years of age, just like Wayne today on his birthday. And he's invited to this wedding. His friends and his family, certainly his mother, we know, and his followers. And in peasant village life in Galilee, a wedding would be a huge occasion, a community occasion. And the bridegroom and his men would make a gala procession through the streets of the village by torchlight, and they would collect the bride and her family and her friends, and then everyone processed back to the groom's house for a huge feast. That feast would last probably 7 days. It was a big do. And everyone would be dressed in their best clothes. There would be music and laughter and dancing. And there would be tables laden with huge platters of food and drink and big jugs of wine. Celebration. And it would last as long as the food and the wine held out. And so you're obviously going back to get more food and going back to get more wine. But the wine has run out, as we know. And Jesus' mother comes to him and tells him. Now, as emergencies go, this isn't life or death. Most of Jesus' signs and his miracles are literally life or death, or, you know, healing of someone who has never walked. This is not a life or death situation. Seems quite a first world problem. You know, we've run out of wine. Is this why the Messiah's come? Just to deal with that kind of problem? Of course, we know that for the family of the groom, this would be a nightmare. This would be a social disaster. People would remember this for a long, long time. It's not me standing up here with my flies undone. This would be a social nightmare not to be able to produce wine for this big occasion. Some people even saw it as it would be bad luck for the couple if wine is not there for the duration. And I love that because I think this tells us something, just as a little bit of an aside, something really important. Jesus is really concerned about commonplace, run-of-the-mill things. You know, we paint the picture of Jesus as only interested in the big things, like saving people. What we might call spiritual things, which I don't particularly like that expression. Renewing lives and saving souls. And yet, here, Jesus steps in to solve a simple problem. And that means that Jesus is concerned about the problems that you're facing and I'm facing today. He's prepared to stop. He's prepared to intervene in the challenges and the frustrations and the difficulties that we face in our work life, in our relationship life, in our financial situation, in our friendships, in the big meeting that you've got this week, in your loneliness, or your hopes, or your fears, or frustration. Sometimes people say, I can't, why would I bother God with that? But actually, nothing is too inconsequential for Jesus. Nothing is too trivial, because Jesus is interested in every part of your life, and he loves you, and he wants to help you to trust him. To ask Jesus for the day-to-day stuff of life is not an inappropriate bothering of the Almighty. It's a mark of humble, trusting faith. You can ask him anything, and he'll love it. How does Jesus respond? I'm not saying he's going to respond to you like this, but how does he respond to his mother? Woman. What concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come. It's a great line. I wish I'd used that when I was a teenager. Michael, go and tidy your room. Woman, what interest is that to you and to me? I think my time would have come a whole lot quicker if I'd have done that. Jesus isn't actually being disrespectful to his mother. That was a customary way for people to talk to each other in those days. But we kind of sense that actually what Mary is saying isn't part of Jesus' plan for this day. He's there to party. He's there to celebrate with everyone. And in some way, everything is going to change now. This is like a hinge where from now on, his destiny is set. If he does this, people are going to flock to him, not just wanting wine, but they're going to want healing, they're going to want deliverance from demonic oppression. There's going to be people who are going to investigate him and come and check him out. The writer Philip Yancey says, if Jesus does this, the clock will be ticking. And it won't stop until Calvary. This is a huge moment. What's he going to do? But Jesus does it. He changes his plans for somebody else. Go and fill the jars with water, he says to the servants who've been told by Mary this brilliant line, do whatever he tells you to do. However strange it may seem, go and do it. And of course, we know that water was strangely obedient to Jesus. He made it. So later on, he speaks to water and to the wind, and he commands it to be still in the storm, and it's obedient to him. Somehow, he commands water to bear his weight so that he can walk on it, on the lake. And here it's water that goes into jars and miraculously wine, and not just cheap plonk, but the really best, the really, really good stuff. And if you do like wine, you would know the difference between the two. You know that when you drink good wine, it is really good. That's what comes out of these jars. It's the wine that would have been served first when the palate is at its most discerning and the feast kicks into gear again and the celebration continues. And this little strange event isn't obvious. It's not public. Actually, only a few people, it would seem, know about it. Mary knows about it. The servants know about it. Jesus knows about it. And his disciples know about it because it says that in verse 11, from then on, they put their faith in him. They believed in him. So this little miracle, this little huge sign was a big thing for his friends. But how does this reveal his glory? How does turning water into wine reveal his glory, which John says is what it does? It's really clever. It met a need. In the Old Testament, God's glory was obvious. It was called the Shekinah glory. And it was found in the cloud. As Moses went up the mountain onto Mount Sinai, he met God. And the glory was so intense that when he came down from the mountain, people had to look away because the glory of God was still radiating from Moses' face. It was so obvious. Do you remember last year we talked about the tabernacle? And it was in the tabernacle that the glory of God came down in the worship. When Solomon dedicated the temple in the Old Testament, that was when God's glory filled the building in such a way that the priests couldn't stand up. They couldn't enter the temple because of this awesome presence of God. But this is not like that. This is not the same kind of glory. Same magnitude or intensity, but John says it reveals Jesus' glory. How? Remember, he says in chapter 1, we've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, full of grace and truth. Now that radiant, divine presence in a person, in a human being, Now that glory of God is visible in a human, in human form, in Jesus Christ. And the glory of God has somehow become incarnated, and it's come among us. Of course, John says he's moved into our neighborhood. The glory of God has come right into the lives of people, even people at a wedding. Yes, he's a man, but he's no mere human who can bear this glory. He is the divine Son of God, bearing within himself the glory of God. But as John says, this is a sign of something else. There's a deep meaning in what Jesus has done. And the clue is in verse 6. This is where we see the glory of God, in these six stone jars. A transformation was taking place in those jars that revealed something of God's heart. They didn't just happen to be jars that were lying around. John actually tells us what they were for. They were for the Jewish rites of purification. Even at a wedding feast, these particular rituals, at times in some ways quite burdensome rituals, to cleanse yourself. It wasn't about hygiene solely. It was about a kind of spiritual cleansing that you were taking as you washed yourself in a certain way. They were coming to a holy God, and those rules had to be observed. And these jars were emblems. They were physical pictures of these rules and obligations and the law. And it says that they were empty. They were empty of the power to cleanse. They were empty to remove the secret stain of the sinful human heart. The jars and all that they had stood for had run dry. But Jesus takes those empty jars and he transforms them and he fills them with new wine. In the Old Testament, the prophets used the image of wine as a sign of the age of salvation, as the age of abundant blessing. And that was accompanied by the arrival of the Messiah. And here Jesus makes nearly, we think, maybe somewhere between 600 and 1,000 bottles. The time for that ritual cleansing is over as Jesus turns water into wine. Israel and the whole world, you and me, can be clean in a new way from the inside out. And this is glorious. This is God's glorious, generous grace. This is a time for celebration. This is about the abundance of the kingdom. The wedding feast of the Messiah has begun. Jesus reveals his glory as he turns water into wine. And earth will never be the same again. That transformation is universal, but it's also personal. If we would let it, this can change us. Not just once, as we are converted from death to life, from darkness to light, not just once in conversion, glorious as that is, but the ongoing transformation of God's work in our lives, the old being replaced by the new. Jesus comes and he offers new wine, new life, and there's more than enough and overflow. He comes to bridge the gap in our lives. He comes to knock down walls that separate us. He comes to repair what is broken down and make new. And he comes to fill our deepest need. He comes to transform. To transform us. You know that our purpose as a church is to be committed followers of Jesus and to make committed followers of Jesus who share his transforming love. Who share his transforming love. We can't share that love If we first have not been transformed by it and filled by it and encountered it ourselves. He wants to change us. To the Jewish people, wine symbolized so many things. As I said, it symbolized salvation, it symbolized blessing, but it also symbolizes joy. And the rabbis had a saying that was, without wine, there is no joy. Without wine, there is no joy. And symbolically at Cana, their joy had run out. And you know, I joy is enduring, but we search for this elusive thing. Some kind of buzz. A temporary dopamine hit of, you name it, retail therapy or some kind of drug or even the misuse of wine, actually. The abuse and misuse of wine. But Jesus says he comes to change us and to offer us a joy and to fill us with his joy. Maybe like the fuel gauge on a car. You know, when you're driving the car, and certainly in my car, a light comes on and it pings a noise. You know, you're running out. You're depleted. And maybe for some of us, we feel that. I don't simply mean in terms of energy, but in terms of joy, of knowing the joy of the Lord, of knowing the joy of knowing God. Maybe some of us recognize we need a kind of deep, profound reconnection with God. We need a reconnection with his love and his grace and his power. Note as well, and I referred to it earlier, that the transformation takes place when some seriously do whatever he tells you. Someone did that. What is Jesus telling you to do today? That when we respond with obedience, transformation and joy comes. I was struck as Judy was praying about Lindy. Many of us will know Lindy, a member of this church for many years, who, as Judy said, left her job, sold her house, I think, sold pretty much everything she had to go and serve on a ship in Africa. Maybe there are people here today who know that God is calling them to do something like that. Not the same as that, but to do something which humanly, in a worldly way, seems crazy. But you just sense that God may be niggling you to do something similar. Do whatever he tells you. As I was preparing for today, I read these words. Jesus turns our water into wine. Our water into wine. We offer ourselves, and he makes of us what we might never think possible. Water into wine is impossible, but for the power of God. But God is continuing to be in that business of transformation, of change. What may seem impossible to you is not impossible to him. So today, can I encourage us to offer ourselves, our water, if you like, to Jesus again? Maybe for some of us, we've been relying on empty religious vessels, empty religion, empty habits that have a kind of semblance of godliness but lack or deny the power of God. In Jesus, God has come in all his glory. And he wants to bring for you and for me an immediacy and an intimacy and a fullness of life. That's what he says in chapter 10. I've come that you may have life to the full, life possible. Maybe for others of us, we recognize that we've lost our first love. Our heart has gone cold. We've lost the joy of knowing Jesus. And one of the fruit of the Spirit is joy. Can't make it happen. We can't whip it up. As the Holy Spirit comes and resides in greater measure in our lives, one of the things he grows in us is joy.